We are on Revelation 19. And I don't think we got very far last week, did we?
I wasn't here.
That's right, you weren't until later.
Yeah, I think somebody called me right at the beginning, and my conversation ended just as you were finishing.
Yeah, I think that is what happened.
I thought we got up to 17.
Did we get clear up to 17?
Wine press, God's all powerful judgment. Yeah, we spent quite a bit of time. We were close to that.
And we decided we'd save it for this week.
But I think we wanted to discuss a little bit more 14, 15, 16 before going on to
I think
angels
that's right.
Standing in the sun.
Yeah. Okay, so starting with Nancy, would you read verses 14, 15, and why don't you read verses 14 and 15?
All right. Free Bible, Revelation 19:14. Heaven's armies were following him, riding on white horses and clothed in fine linen, white and clean. From his mouth came a sharp sword to strike the nations. He will rule them with an iron rod, and he himself treads the winepress of God, the all-powerful's judgment. 14 and 15.
You read, and on his robe and his thigh, he has the name inscribed, King of Kings and Lord of Lords.
14. No, I thought you just said 14 and 15, so I didn't read 16.
No, 14 to 16.
Okay, all right. So written on his robe and on his thigh was the name King of Kings and Lord of Lords.
It in my Bible, it makes a paragraph change about the end of that. That's why I wanted that included. Any questions or comments? Open discussion.
I have a question that has to do with the thigh. What's the symbolism of the thigh?
That's a good question. I don't know that it has the most savory answer to that.
But I would probably agree with you.
Let's use a biblical illustration.
It's tied to Jacob, isn't it?
Abraham.
Yeah.
Abraham is talking to Eliezer, his servant, about going to get a wife for not Jacob, is it? It's
Isaac.
Isaac.
Isaac. Yeah. Getting a wife for Isaac.
Oath to swear.
He has him place his hand under his thigh.
Right.
And swearing an oath. And commentators think that that has to do with the sexual organs of virility and power.
And also reproduction.
So that if you put your hand under the thigh, you really mean that you're going to go and do what he said you're going to do.
Okay.
And it's related to your genealogy.
Say more.
Well, I mean, the sexual reproduction is where your progenitors are going to come from.
Yeah, true.
And it's also the most vulnerable part of his body. So he's saying, I am going to trust you with the most vulnerable part of myself to keep this promise.
Yeah.
And I think really the same thing applies to Jacob in his wrestling.
Well, that's right. God strikes his thigh.
Yeah, he hits his thigh.
Actually, in the Hebrew, it's he touches his thigh.
Right, right.
And it caused that touch causes it to go out. And that's what tells Jacob. That's what tells Jacob that this is gone, because only God could do that with a touch.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. It wasn't an angel or a man. Well, that kind of answers my question, because those two examples were what came to mind when we talked about the sky.
So you can think of Jesus on the cross, completely unclothed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We don't, artists don't paint pictures of him that way. It
No.
would be too
No, no.
horrible and shocking to everybody.
Yeah.
But think of him in that position, it's so vulnerable. So, in such a shameful position in terms of that culture in that time.
And yet, what was the purpose of Jesus coming to do that? Was to reverse the curse that brought shame onto the nakedness in Eden.
That's true.
The nakedness was never the problem, it's the shame. And so he came to undo the shame. So here in Revelation, basically he's conquering the shame right here and claiming through this symbol that he is now the father, the ultimate ancestor of every human being. So that's part of his authority now. And the name on his thigh is the name of everyone who's willing to accept that name, because the name is their identity. And they receive their identity from him. And so the sexual organ would be the symbol of he's our father.
Okay.
He has the name, it's literally a title, King of Kings and Lord of Lords, means that this is the way he reigns. It's from his costly sacrifice, his emptying himself out. That this is the way he reigns. This is now back to the Lamb, chapter 5.
Which is again of self-sacrifice, what you just described. It's not like earthly kings who rule through a dynasty and they're just the next son or whoever's next in line, but because of the way he deals with sin, the way he deals with our shame.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, well, anything else on in this these verses?
Have you read, I think it's regarding the treading the wine press alone.
We worked on that. We tried to figure out what the wine press was.
Did you read Isaiah 63?
Yeah, we did, I believe.
Okay. Is that's directly, in fact, that's a direct quote.
Yes. We went back and forth with that. Well, are we ready to go for 17? Or do we want to spend some more time with these verses?
I just wanted to say one thing, as I looked at Isaiah 63 last week, but not this week. And it's interesting that in the good news, the title of Isaiah 63 is the Lord's victory over the nations. So it's interesting that that is what he's talking about, to
His
rule them.
victory over the nations, and note how he wins that victory over the nations. It's not by killing them with the sword, it's by giving, being the word and giving them the word.
And I think I mentioned previously that the way God destroys the nations is not, like you say, it's not by killing people, but by dissolving the very concept of the divisive concept of nations and bringing everyone back into unity under one father and one family. Because the very concept of nations is divisive, and that they're separate families. They fight each other, they compete with each other. That's, the whole concept of sin, is to divide and conquer. And so God is undoing, well, I mean, nationalities really started at the Tower of Babel, didn't they? That divisiveness. So he is undoing the curse of the Tower of Babel.
Well, it seems that the nationalities that we, if you look at the Middle East today, a nationality war basically that's taking place. It's true, we have ceasefire right now, but it's there's still the warring mentality there. One of the things I think that he overcomes the nations is to overcome animosity, overcome the tendency to battle and war and hate, all of those things. He came to overcome that. And that is where he's victorious. I don't think we as Adventists have ever really dealt with that appropriately. Our tendency is to be fairly nationalist. Our tendency is to be fairly unmindful of the fact that in heaven, everybody, every color, every tribe, every nation is going to be represented. And they will be our friends and neighbors. And are we ready for that?
Brad and I are reading through the Bible. We're a little bit behind, so we're going through a bunch of Paul's letters, and almost every single one of his letters talks about this multi-ethnic family. You know, and so many, I mean, other books of the Bible also, and it keeps it's over and over and over again. And I go, I really haven't seen that in the way that I wasn't taught that very well in terms of, being a Christian and patriotic American, you know. Like that does not have a place really in terms of,
The only way I can remember as a child learning that is in red and yellow, black and white, all are precious in his sight, which was cradle. That was the last word of it, which is sad.
So Anna is with me.
Hi, Anna.
Hi, Anna. Welcome.
This is weird.
Yeah.
Hi.
So glad to have you.
Thank you.
So I want to say, who's Anna?
Oh, you weren't here when she was here last time, I guess.
No, I've missed a couple because I was in Tennessee. So welcome. We don't have to go in now. Welcome, Anna. Glad
Okay.
to have you join our group again.
Yes.
What we've been talking about, Anna, is this King of Kings and Lord of Lords and how he's overcoming the nations by his love and his kindness, and by teaching them, undoing this animosity and hatred that seems to be so rampant among the nations. By living the life he lived here on earth, by dying the death he died, and being vulnerable, and just all the ways he's treated people apart from. The story comes to my mind of Jesus and the Syrophoenician woman, and how the disciples were trying to send her away, and Jesus ministered to her and said, "Your daughter lives, or your daughter is whole." Yes, it is. That's an example of how Jesus treated the nations. And yes, at the beginning he seems to be cold, but Ellen White makes the very wonderful statement in Desire of Ages that he could not hide his love from her, that she found that she knew he loved her. It could be in the compassionate way he said those words. And we tend to read those words as severe and un-Christ-like, but he said those words with compassion, and she's responded to that compassion.
With a twinkle in his eye, because she knew what he meant and he knew what he meant, but the disciples were shaking their heads, going, "What in the world?"
We were talking in Sabbath school class today about Jesus' answer to questions is often very puzzling to me until you realize that he almost always, it's puzzling to me because he never seems to actually answer his questions, never gives a straight answer to a question, but it's always to lead someplace even better because they're kind of asking the wrong questions. So a better question would be, and then he answers the question they should have asked. Here again, he gives a kind of an off what seems to be an off the wall answer, but it's as was just mentioned, is because some of the listeners would have really had to scratch their heads and say, wait a minute, what? That was not at all what I was expecting.
I'm wondering what Jesus does that we can actually expect other than keep his word, you know what I mean? He kind of was out of the box on so many things. And I'm looking at this thigh in context. You know, not only was the thigh associated with oath giving, but it says Jesus' thigh was written the name. We know what the name represents, a character. So here you have an oath about a guy's character, and this is the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. So that's kind of meaningful to me when I tie that all together.
Yeah, I like that.
I think it's important that when that title King of Kings and Lord of Lords is a confrontation to the very definition of those words. So he redefines king from our typical concept of kings. He redefines Lord from our typical concept of Lord.
Yes.
Yes. That's, I think, the central key to Revelation is how we define the Lamb, and how the Lamb versus the Beast really sets in complete portrayal of what Revelation is really about.
And the other application ties back to chapter 1, where it says he has made us a kingdom of priests. And also, I think he has made us kings, or made us kings and priests. And so he is the king, and everybody in his kingdom are kings.
Or princesses, or queens, maybe?
Queens would be closer, yeah.
Sorry.
That is a different connotation in our culture, but yeah. Anyway.
I may have dealt with this back way, way back when we dealt with chapter 1. So I forgive me if I repeat myself from then. It seems to me that the kingdom of priests and a holy nation is actually fundamentally begun in Exodus 19, when God mentioned that for the first time to Israel. He does it to Moses, and Moses is supposed to convey that to the people. And that kingdom of priests is one of equality, one of oneness, and everyone who heard God thunder the law from Sinai are in that kingdom of priests and holy nation, and the whole people are standing at the foot of Sinai hearing that amazing presentation of the law. So everyone is a king, and it's in the kingdom of priests and holy nation. So Jesus takes that here in Revelation to apply to all his family, regardless of what nation, regardless of what genealogy they have, regardless of the color of their skin, and regardless of their ethnicity and their cultural biases and all of that. They are all part of his kingdom of priests and holy nation.
You know, I was thinking before this started that I have this notion that kind of pops into my head every once in a while that a lot of, looking at this from the viewpoint of the hereafter, all the people that came out of earth and God can heal and welcome into his kingdom, the stuff that it talks about in Revelation, in particular about the saint, I think it basically includes all of humanity. He's not just talking about some tiny little set. He's basically talking about all of humanity that eventually wind up on his side. I don't know. That's just a that's a proposition, not a statement of belief. But anyway, just the context of what you were saying, I thought, yeah, I should see how that resonates with others.
Yeah, because you know, this is a little different statement, but it could, I think you can apply it to this concept. Some months, many months ago, I think I was asked to present for the Adventist Today Sabbath School class that meets on Zoom. And I was asked the last minute because the person who was originally supposed to do it canceled out. And they asked a friend of mine who sicked them on to me. And I had to present. And I had only a little time to prepare. So I thought, what can I do in this short time? And I decided to present on the three and three models, the Babylonian models and God's models. And of course, the Babylonian models are the models we're most familiar with. And the models of God's kingdom are the models of creation are the models that we are least familiar with. And that really showed up in that class. They were baffled. They didn't know what to do with what I was telling them. Floyd's nodding his head. He was there. And I was a bit amazed because I've lived with this view for so long that to me it seems just normal. But to them, it seemed impossible.
Oh.
We had to finally reassure them. I think Barbara Ricketts was there, and she said, look, guys, this is what it will be in heaven. We may not meet it, do it perfectly down here, but this is what it will be like in heaven. And I still sensed that everybody was like, what? It really made me realize how far we are from being ready.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
All of that.
When you start challenging the very hidden foundations of how we perceive reality
mm-hmm.
as we live it, and you start challenging the basic assumptions that nobody even discusses because it's just assumed and nobody ever questions
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm.
You begin questioning those things, it's terrifying. It took me years to acclimate to those things. I started listening to your recordings, I don't know, 30 years ago, and heard you talking about the three foundations of civilization. And I remember the shock that I had, especially when you said law. And I'm like, what? What do you mean law? You know, law is the foundation of God's government. How can she say that? And then you unpacked it and like, oh, yeah, wow, that makes a lot of sense. And, you know, that teaching there has been literally the new foundation upon which practically everything I teach now makes sense. But when I bring that up for other people, that, you know, you get the same shockwaves because it threatens everything,
mm-hmm.
not just religiously, but everything.
I remember telling some friends, some larger view friends, that when I get to the new earth, I'm not going to build a house. I want to live in nature.
Yeah.
I will build a yard and build all the, or plant all the things that I want to have in my home. But I don't plan to build a house. And they didn't know what to do with me.
Well, I mean, isn't that how it's described in as far as Adam and Eve living?
Mm-hmm.
And to Floyd's point there, think of how radical what Jesus was trying to tell them sounded. It's no wonder he didn't answer their questions directly.
Right.
I was just, I don't know where I saw this, but it was saying that the early Christians didn't form another church. And nobody knew quite what to do with them, to the point that the Romans essentially thought of them as atheists because their view of God didn't match anything that they were used to.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe we can be sympathetic with the Pharisees who, you know, Jesus is asking them to let go of everything they've held sacred.
They didn't, they shared everything in common. We don't believe in communism, you know.
Yeah, it's communism right there. It's at least socialism.
But those are all the counterfeits because they lack the spontaneity of love.
Exactly.
And replace it with force and fear.
Kind of like capitalism.
So you're trying to get the same, you're trying to get the same results with opposite motives, and it'll never work.
Right.
Kind of like capitalism.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we tend to say that, we tend to say that about communism and socialism, and don't realize that capitalism, the system we're under, is based on the exact same things of fear and power over. Survival of the fittest is at the foundation of capitalism. So our system is every bit as corrupt as any of those others.
Yeah.
I hate to get political, but at some point we have to say our view of God and what we're talking about has some real real implications in the world around us right now.
Oh, definitely.
Oh, it does. Definitely. We're on a roller coaster ride somewhere very fast.
And it doesn't look good.
You know, my brother told me the other day, Gene, don't look at the news. It's too depressing.
So it's interesting that right at this juncture in the flow of this chapter, it suddenly unveils maybe an angel standing in the sun. Not, I mean, you know, the woman in chapter 12 is standing on a moon clothed with the sun. And now you have an angel standing in the sun. I wonder what the correlation is.
Well, would it relate to Malachi, son of righteousness?
With healing in his wings? Yeah, that would, healing in his ways.
He is, isn't he the son?
Yeah. But we just had the rider on the white horse, which is clearly Jesus. Now you've got an angel standing in the sun. Is that just a switch of metaphor, or what is it?
Well, I find the Bible does switch metaphors, so I wouldn't be surprised.
Especially in Revelation.
What other angel? What other angel would stand in the sun? You know.
A lot of times you can get good clues about what kind of angel, because some of them are suspect, by analyzing their message, is what I found. And this is a rather curious message, too.
It's a little...
macabre?
It almost seems contrary to the Lamb kind of message.
Yeah.
Nancy, would you read 17 to 21?
Yes.
I think we're ready for this.
Again, Free Bible. I saw an angel standing in the sun, shouting in a loud voice to all the birds that fly in the sky, "Come and gather together for God's great feast. Here you can eat the flesh of the dead, kings, leaders, and powerful men, as well as that of horses and their riders, the flesh of all people, free and slave, great and small. I saw the beast and the kings of the earth gathered together to wage war on the one sitting on the horse and his army. The beast was captured, along with the false prophet, who performed miracles in his presence, by which he deceived those who had received the mark of the beast and those who worshipped the beast image. Both of them were thrown alive into the lake of fire that burns with sulfur. The rest were killed with the sword of the one sitting on the horse, the sword that came out of his mouth. All the birds gorged themselves on their flesh."
Well, the only time that Jesus talked about cannibalism, that's, of course, we're eating dead meat, which is about the most gross thing you could say to a Jewish group of people, isn't it?
Well, except the birds are doing it this time.
I mean, eating dead meat.
But the birds are doing it, not people.
I'm sorry?
The birds are doing it here, not the people.
Okay, that's true.
It's better than leaving live meat.
The cause to the bird. That's right.
And the birds, everything in Revelation is a symbol. And as close as I can tell, the birds usually represent demonic spirits. As far as I could tell, birds usually represent, of course, carrion here, represent demonic spirits that, of course, love to go around and feast on people spiritually. So I think this is almost the summary of the final demise. I mean, it's just ticking off the demise of all the opponents of the Lamb, and that they're mm-hmm. and that they are going to become food for the demonic spirits, because there's no hope left for them, and their life is expired. I mean, their hope is expired, maybe, is to put it better.
I listened probably 2 weeks ago now to Siegfried Tonstad's focus on this chapter. And one of the things he said that was helpful at the time, he says, remember, the book of Revelation was written for people who were undergoing persecution. And my understanding is to always understand who was being written to, and what was the purpose of the writing. And John was writing to encourage these people who are going through horrendous persecution and faced more to come, right? And so he says part of this symbology is an affirmation of that God is going to win in the end, and that his success is sure. And so when you get into some of this graphic detail, it was helpful for me to say, oh, he's saying that everyone that opposes God and God's people will ultimately meet, you know, he's victorious over them. So, and I'm not saying as well as he said, you know, there wasn't a focus on vindictiveness or, you know, because part of this is very unappealing, right? But it was God wins. Keep your focus. God wins. Don't forget that. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. But how he wins is important. How he wins is important. And the sword that comes out of the mouth is the truth. And they have rejected it.
The truth about
it. It reflects the word of God, which can, mm-hmm. I think has dual meaning. Jesus is the word.
Mm-hmm.
Even just saying it's the truth of the word, though, is not enough, because you have to say, what is it the truth about? And it's about the character and mm-hmm. love of God.
Yes.
That's the thing that really mm-hmm. clinches this, is God's love becomes clear to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And you either like it and say, yeah, I would like to be part of that. Or you say, nah, I understand. I understand this really is a kingdom of love, but I don't want anything to do with it, which is crazy, but there it is, you know. Mm-hmm. Sin is in fact crazy.
I think that's highlighted in Romans 2:4. It's really focused on, you know, that do you despise the mercy and kindness and graciousness of God, not understanding that it's the kindness of God that leads you to repentance. Mm-hmm. That is the truth that is most divisive. Is if God's going to be kind to your enemies,
mm-hmm.
then you're maybe likely to switch gods.
Mm-hmm.
Because nobody wants God to be kind to their enemies unless they're willing to follow the Lamb wherever he goes.
I had a counselor I was talking about. He wasn't very spiritual, but not Christian. And I was talking about the using the metaphor of darkness. And he said, there's nothing wrong with darkness. And I had to think about that for a while. And it wasn't until my next session with him that I said, you know, it's not the darkness. It's the rejection of the light. And I really stick with that. That is, it's not that we're unloving. It's that we reject love.
It's a choice.
Anyway,
mm-hmm.
I don't know quite how to say that, switching it over, but the idea that it's not darkness, but the rejection of light that's really the problem.
And that phrase is repeated over and over and over in the book Great Controversy. She uses a phrase to describe the lost and calls them the rejectors of God's mercy.
Yes.
And that is their key problem.
Yes.
That's their identifier, is they're rejecting mercy.
Well, and here you have it, where the beasts, the kings of the earth, they're all gathered together to wage war on Jesus. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, he's been at war, and now everybody in those positions are waging war from the sky that's coming from the skies, which is pretty ridiculous, you know, but they are ultimately rejecting the light.
Right.
And waging war, they want to destroy, right along with this, mm-hmm. with Satan.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Because they know he's coming to rescue his people. So they're trying to take him out so they can turn around and take his people out, right? This is chronologically, Jesus is showing up just when we need the rescue and everything's going under for his believers, right? So it's in that context that you see that animosity, darkness, hating the light.
It's like all the power structures
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Are being completely annihilated.
Mm-hmm.
The kingship is done. No more kings. The beasts, empires, and kingdoms are done. The captains of mighty people, the horses and their riders, which was a symbol of war, the warriors, everyone who has exercised power on earth and has resembled the beast and resembled the dragon, everyone is going to be gone. So we won't have the systems of the world anymore. I almost see, I recognize that it's talking about, you can't do away with kingdoms without doing away with people who run them and that sort of thing. But this isn't doing away with them as much as it is letting things transpire to the point where everything is annihilated.
Mm-hmm.
And this is going to tell us what that is. Yeah, if you look at the bottom of the list, these two were, it says the beast and the false prophet were thrown alive into the lake of fire that burns with sulfur. And the rest were killed by the sword of the rider on the mouth, the sword that comes from his mouth, and all the birds gorged on their flesh. That sword is the word of God. It is the truth, as you've mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the how it's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And the next chapter is going to be even more on the how.
Mm-hmm. That entire list itemizes the symbols of power through warfare and the symbols of hierarchy.
Mm-hmm. Basically, mm-hmm. I think you have the whole three models.
Yeah.
Because money is power.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you have economics there.
And I remember the first time when I read through this section and suddenly realized that what I'd been taught growing up didn't fit, because this is the first of three lakes of fire.
Mm.
And I never heard of such a notion before. It's like there's one lake of fire, but clearly this is at a different timestamp than the other two mentions of lakes of fire, and all three of them have specific hallmarks attached to them that make them three different things. And it appears pretty strongly that this lake of fire is before the second coming. And it confirms for me that because the beast and the false prophet are thrown alive into the lake of fire really refers to this lake of fire, particularly as the wrath of humanity, who now see unmistakably clear the exploitation that's been done to them by these entities.
So could one lake of fire be the latter rain?
No, I think that happened long before this.
I'm not talking about this particular lake of fire. I'm just thinking of the three.
Right. Well, I think the primary definition of that fire is the revelation of God's glory, which is in passionate love. And that certainly is going to be seen and becomes the, you know, becomes a fire.
But, that's what I'm talking
right.
about.
But I think particularly in this case, if not in all three cases, it also includes the wrath of man, because the wrath of man, fueled by exposure to the selfless love of God, which only inflames their fury, turns on each other. And in this case, it turns on all these exploitive powers that have deceived and manipulated them to do all the dirty work. And now they realize they've been duped and used, and they turn their fury on their leadership. They turn their fury on the institutions or whatever these things represent. And they're thrown alive into it because they're alive. And they're thrown to the very lions that they've been using to feed on God's people, metaphorically. It's actually parallels very much the story of Daniel in the lion's den. You know, the 144,000 are Daniel. And then when the king realizes he's been duped by these people, he pulls Daniel out and throws them in alive. And the world that was manipulated, the lions represent the world that was exploited and manipulated by these powers, now are at the mercy of those powers, and there is no mercy.
I always understood Jesus coming on the white horse, and especially in the context of we are, you know, the Lamb's wedding feast, which comes before this description, to be Jesus at the second coming. So I've always understood this fire to be the inability of those of the beast and those individuals aligned with him to stand in the presence of God. You know, I mean, we've covered the one where the woman who sits on the beast is destroyed by those merchants. You know, I've never seen that. I've just always seen that. Yay, Jesus comes, and those oppositional forces aligned with Satan are taken out because Jesus just shows up. Light, you know, who can stand in the presence of a holy God? And they cannot. And that's my understanding of what is this fire, because the next thing we see is, you know, Satan goes into 1,000 years of isolation because there's nobody there to tempt. We're in heaven with Jesus celebrating the Lamb's wedding feast. That's how I've seen it. I haven't seen it.
I would agree for that time stamp. However, I've had to go back and question how again. You know, we keep saying, well, how does it happen? Not just what happens. And actually, in reading Great Controversy, I begin seeing clues, strong clues, that it's actually, okay, again, I said it's a combination of the revelation of God, you know, his presence. But that's not the only thing. It's also the wrath of people who find out they've been exploited. And when I read Great Controversy, she talks about that when she's not just directly quoting from scripture, which is just generic, but when she begins describing it, she talks about the people turning on each other in fury, especially their religious leaders, and calling them out and the terror they're experiencing. And then the slaughter begins, and it actually parallels the few times in the Old Testament when God's people allowed God to rescue them 100% without any human interference. And in every case, when they allowed God to do that, the enemies turned on each other and destroyed each other till the last man. And I believe that defines how it's going to happen at the second coming, because we're still stuck in this paradigm that we grew up with, that Jesus is going to come and basically incinerate everybody he doesn't take home with him. And that just does not match the revelation of Jesus in the Gospels.
Do you mean his presence or his consuming glory incinerates?
The Second Thessalonians says that they were destroyed by the brightness of his coming.
Right, that's right, my understanding. Right.
But if you look at that passage and you look up that word, it does not mean what it looks like in English. And somebody pointed that out to me a few years ago, and that was also very actually contributed to this view, because...
Well, what word doesn't... What word are you referencing that is different in English than it is in...
Well, let me find it. If you know where it is real quick. I've got notes there, but I'd have to find the reference.
No rush. No worries.
It's not First Thessalonians, I believe, 4, chapter 4.
Yeah, that's what I was looking. It does talk about the second coming, but it doesn't use that phrase. In fact, I think it might be Peter. Let me see if I have a reference here.
You can find it later. I don't want to hijack.
I'm wondering.
It is important, I think.
While you're looking, Floyd, probably when you find it, I was just wondering, too, if... is there any reaping of what people have sown going on? I mean, Galatians 6:8 is pretty clear about what we reap, what we sow. And I don't know that that says how, but if all the four winds to the corners of the earth are being pulled back, if God's, I mean, God's interfered with us experiencing the full consequence of sin, as I understand it. So if that no longer happens, I mean, people are reaping what they sow, I guess. And it certainly isn't Jesus. You know, the word that comes out of his mouth, the sword of truth, whatever it is that we want to describe there. Keeping in mind, this is the same person said in John 8:35, you men look on the outward appearance, I look on the heart, and I don't judge anyone. So, I mean, I don't know. If Jesus, some people, my great friends, they believe this next time Jesus shows up, it's full judgment, pedal to the metal. That's why he comes.
Floyd?
Yeah.
2 Thessalonians 2:8.
Okay. The Lord will slay or consume by the breath of his mouth and the brightness. Okay. Oh, yeah. Okay, I knew it was a big revelation. That word brightness is epiphany.
Well, that's why I think the NRSV has appearance instead of brightness.
Yeah, because, you know, we think, oh, it's a literal physical brightness that literally physically burns people up, which is where we get in trouble with the lake of fire too. It's a spiritual awakening. It's their eyes being opened to the reality that they've been in denial of all this time. And their facade is destroyed. And as a result, what we're reading right here in Revelation, the result is they turn on each other in fury because they now see the truth. They don't accept the truth that God is love, but the epiphany, the brightness, is the breakthrough into the darkness. Those who hate the light still get exposed by the light, and it's an epiphany. It's a huge epiphany. Mm-hmm. And their reaction to that revelation is they turn and destroy each other.
There's also the breath of his mouth, which I've wondered if it isn't when he breathes into the righteous that he raises from the dead.
And that's true, too, because
he breathes into their nostrils the breath of life.
Yeah. I think the wicked kill each other after he leaves. There's nobody else left on the earth but the wicked, and they make short work of each other. And that's consistent, again, with the stories of the Old Testament where God was allowed to let his enemies destroy each other instead of God directly intervening. And I think those are the best illustrations to demonstrate how light overcomes darkness. Darkness destroys itself.
Not to be too much of a gadfly, but isn't that a little cruel?
Is it cruel to leave people to their own choices?
Yeah.
I guess it depends how one defines cruel, but if there's absolutely nothing else God can do, it would be disrespectful to not respect their choice.
Unnecessary suffering is what I'm what I'm looking at there.
It's certainly in contrast to genocide.
That's not the only other option. Part of this comes from my discomfort with God allowing the suffering to continue just to prove his point. Mm-hmm. Unless there's some good reason, I think God would just end suffering. So unless there's some good reason that he has to allow them to kill each other rather than just terminating their life, which he could do instantly and painlessly.
Right.
I would, that's the genesis of my question is why doesn't God just say, okay, you're done?
Because it can be mistaken as him being complicit in the death of someone if he takes their life. And I think the only way that the safety of the universe is ensured forever is that God's reputation has to be saved completely, completely. And the only way he can do that is to allow evil to completely expose itself, completely free of any interference or meddling on his behalf, or even speeding it up.
Hasn't that already been done at this point?
I don't think it's done until the very last day of judgment, after the millennium.
Again, just a question.
Yeah. I mean, I'm following the logic of the passage. And then, you know, the backstory that we've been given and putting the pieces together, and it makes sense to me. Sometimes it challenges our own paradigms. But for me, it's the only solution that effectively eliminates any lingering doubts or questions about God's relationship to sin and sinners and his claim that he is only love and light and that he is not to blame for anything. And clearly God's the one on trial, because we're constantly judging God and blaming him for stuff. And those questions have to be answered fully. And I think the best way to answer them is for God to simply let evil bear full fruit until there's nothing left of it.
Well, if one casts that in the context of future generations, I might see that. I'm still a little disturbed by the idea that God declaring his name justifies suffering, but I'll think about it some more. This is an ongoing question of mine.
And, you know, and the question really is it imposed suffering or is it self-imposed suffering?
Well, see, so that's kind of where I start to diverge a little bit, is that there's no question in my mind, nor do I think there's question on looking universe's mind, that this is about imposed suffering. So if it's not about him, if nobody has a question that this is imposed, it's hard for me to understand why God can't just say, okay, this is done. Let's put these people out of their misery.
Yeah, I don't think at this point, particularly the second coming, there's a lot of questions about God's character. That's what the whole war is.
Well, this is we're not talking about the second coming, though. We're talking about the final destruction. At least that's what I thought.
Okay, I think here in Revelation 19, it's a second coming.
Yeah, I think so too.
That does make a difference.
Yeah.
Because the onlooking universe hasn't had a chance to review us and our perspective on God's handling of the mercy, which is why God doesn't just end it right then. Because that's another question of mine is, why would God bring, these people are dead. Why bring them back for them to die all over again, you know? Mm-hmm. There better be a pretty good reason for it.
Yeah, well, for sure.
I love how Ezekiel 33:11 says, turn ye from your evil ways, for why will you die? When I listen to what Jesus talked about the end of times, you know, he was talking about weeping and gnashing of teeth. I think that inner agony is the profound one where they go, God reached out to me here. He reached out to me here and here and here. And I said, no, no, no. And so I think it's an inner, you know, full-blown panic attack, whatever. It's a terrible coming to terms with their repeated choices. That's the true agony, I think, that Revelation so often depicts.
I guess my confusion over whether this was the second coming or the third was that I have had that picture of them turning on each other, but I really thought that, at least from the E.G. White account, that was when they go up to attack the
that's my understanding.
Attack the city at the very, very end. But maybe I've got the chronology wrong there. I don't know.
I think it's the reverse of that, because I don't even think she mentions anything about them turning on each other at that point. But at the second coming is the first major explosive revelation of who's actually serving God and who isn't, and that they have been deceived by the beast and the false prophet. And I think that's where she actually spends quite a bit of time talking about turning on the false teachers and the false ministers who deliberately deceived people, and they realize.
She does talk about that in terms of the last day events.
Yes.
When Babylon is exposed.
Yes.
But she also makes a statement in Great Controversy. And I clearly remember this. At the end of the millennium, she says, after the great movie that they see where everything, it stops their advance against the city.
Right.
After that, they realize that it is their fault, but it's also the fault of Satan.
Oh yeah.
And they turn on him.
Yes.
And they turn on one another, anybody who they think has been to blame for where they are. And there, she says, there follows a scene of universal strife.
Yeah.
Is what she says. And then the glory of God is revealed.
Right.
That one's at the very end?
Yeah.
That one's at the very end? Okay.
Yeah. Yes.
I think that turning on Satan is the metaphor of the second lake of fire, because it's only Satan who goes into that lake of fire. But that lake of fire is identified as the same one that previously, which is here, where the beast and the false prophet were thrown. But they've already been in there. They went in there at this point in time. Later, Satan goes in there solely, and then later, everybody else goes in there that's not written in the Book of Life. So there's three times, three distinct different times.
I will check that out, Floyd. That's a new, see if I agree or not with you. My jury's still out.
I was shocked the first time I saw it too. And that when Satan is thrown in is also described, what is it, in Ezekiel 28? Or is it Isaiah 14? They will draw their swords against your beauty. It's the same description. And again, I don't think it's about physical killing. I think it's about destroying their credibility and their reputation and their following. Nobody will ever give them the time of day after that. There's no hope for Satan ever recovering any credibility after that point. And that's the metaphor of the lake of fire, is the fire is consuming all credibility beyond hope of ever getting any back.
You don't see any physical component to this at all?
I believe, based on my own research and conviction, that the ultimate final death of anyone, Satan, angels, wicked, whoever, is self-inflicted. Otherwise, somebody else is to blame. In fact, the reason I believe that is a lot. I mean, it'd take a while to explain it, but I'm convinced that at the last resurrection of the lost, they are given conditional immortality. And the only condition is that they want to keep it. And the reason I believe that is because if they didn't have that option, they would start killing each other off immediately. And that would just complicate things. And so God literally pulls Satan's bluff, you know, saying, oh, God's not fair. And God and says, okay, here, I'll give you conditional immortality and you can keep it as long as you want to. You can live forever if you want to. The problem is they're tormented. They're tormented in the presence of love, and they're tormented. And that's the length of the fire, is how long do you want to be tormented by love before you finally say, I'd rather be dead than to live in love. And that's various times for various people.
So I'm not sure I understood the answer to my question. Is there a physical component to all this?
I think after they have chosen to die, there is a physical fire. Yes. After they're dead. And that's reinforced, and Gene pointed this out years ago in the sanctuary service, that no animal was ever, ever, ever burned alive. They were always dead when they were burned. Now, prostitutes that were daughters of priests were burned alive.
Not animals.
Not animals. Yeah, not animals.
They're not a type of this.
No, they're not.
Thank God for that.
They might be a type of the beast in the image being thrown alive into the lake of fire, and the great harlot being burned alive.
Yeah, that can be, but not.
But not the final demise of the lost or Satan. I believe they choose to come back like Judas and throw the gift of eternal life down in front of God and say, take it back, I don't want it, and don't you dare ever resurrect me again. And that exonerates God's reputation more than anything you could imagine throughout the rest of history. The rest of history, future, is that it becomes absolutely explicitly clear that everyone who perished chose to reject life itself. When they were given the gift of immortal life and they rejected that, what else can God do? If he refuses their demand to take it back, now he's violating their free will.
I absolutely agree with that. That nobody is lost by accident.
No.
It's always with full knowledge and full intention, and I believe to the extent possible, fully restored faculties.
Yeah,
and they still say, not only do I not want this, but as you well put it there, don't you dare ever bring me back again to ask me this question again.
Yeah. Because it's unequivocally clear that there will never be a safe place in the universe where sinners could hide out from love, because love will pervade everything and everywhere. And there's no place to escape.
There was no place for them in heaven.
And if you can't escape, then it's nothing but torture for those who are unfit to live in love.
Exactly. Love is more powerful than hate.
Yeah.
So think about when the angels fell from heaven. There was no room found for them in heaven, it says.
Right. That's right.
That war, how they fought, was that agony of love.
Yes.
They fought. The loyal angels fought with love.
And because heaven's atmosphere was completely saturated with love, which includes vulnerability, and evil angels hated both of those things, they couldn't find any place to hide from love in heaven. And they had to go where there was darkness.
There was no room for them in heaven.
Yeah.
They had to leave.
And the same thing happens at the end. There's no room left in the universe.
That's why Jude says they left their former, is it Jude? They left their former dwelling.
Yep.
God didn't throw them out like we've always been taught.
They abandoned it.
They abandoned their former dwelling.
Yes.
So I think that when we get past everything and everything is done, we will be able to look back through all the things that we were taught and wrongly taught.
Yeah.
About God, and see how he was not the one doing it at every single instance.
And that's the video you talked about.
I think everything will be clear. Mm-hmm. And that's what will save everybody for eternity.
That's what will secure God's reputation for eternity.
Exactly.
Yeah. And that's the salvation of our God and his Christ, mentioned repeatedly in Revelation, because the salvation of God is the restoration of full trust in his government, where there's complete freedom and nothing but love.
That's why I think it's so important that there is that 1,000 years where yes. Everyone, people who don't even know Jesus's name, they get clear. They get clear about how God's operates. Mm-hmm. Those questions about why is he taking out this person or that person, you know, and I think that's why the sequencing is important before God gives them up and lets them go. Everybody needs to be absolutely clear about this is an act of love. Mm-hmm. And looking over lives will give additional clarity to those repeated choices. However, those when the books are open and we're judging, we're saying, well, what's the real deal here? And it'll be very clear that those who are goats chose to be goats, those who are sheep chose to be sheep. You know, those who chose to be wicked still, no matter what God did. So I'm glad the sequencing is the way it is.
And equally, that same conclusion has to be arrived at by the lost. So they are resurrected after the righteous have had 1,000 years to process. Then they're resurrected and they're given whatever time they need to have those same questions answered from their perspective.
Yeah, from their life story. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's why I think that final movie is so important. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They see it all happen. Yeah.
Everybody sees it all.
Yes, everybody, righteous and wicked alike.
And even the quasi-doubting universe.
I think they're pretty clear. I think they're pretty clear by now.
Well, the onlooking universe is pretty clear, but if you think about it, I don't think for a moment that God's creation has halted. Maybe it's been interrupted for a little bit, but there's an untold number of beings who will come along after us who have not seen all this.
Yeah.
And God's going to make sure that we don't have to run this experiment again in order to get additional data.
Yeah.
Right.
So.
Nobody wants to run the experiment again. Yes.
What's that?
Nobody wants to run that experiment again. I don't think God has to do anything. Everybody goes, no. I know.
Well, so if that's the case, then letting this play out is unnecessary suffering. And I have a problem with that.
We'll get to talk about that more.
No, I don't know.
What's that? So if God knows, if God knows that it's not ever going to be a problem for anybody ever again, then letting this all play out to make sure that the proof is there is unnecessary suffering.
I thought that's how freedom worked, that you let people make choices and let them experience the consequences of those choices. You know, I don't, and the suffering is something self-induced. It isn't God creating this suffering. It's living outside of design, my understanding, that creates suffering.
Well, so this comes from my understanding that I've got from many places that left to itself, sin would not only self-destroy, it would do so immediately. And that God has had to artificially keep Lucifer and his followers alive so that this could play out. So this brings me back to my thing that if God knew that wasn't really necessary, then that was unnecessary suffering. So part of this is my, I have a, what's the word I'm looking for? Not heretical, but non-standard view of the difference between the past and the future. I don't think that the future is out there and exists because I think there's a problem with freedom in that case. So part of this is me saying, the future really is up to the beings that come along hereafter, and that God needs to make sure that whatever evidence anybody might possibly want at any time in the eternity, it has been achieved here and now. So my difference in view is why I can't except the God just looks out in the future and fixes it. Yeah, that's why that response doesn't resonate with me, because I don't think reality works that way.
Well, it sounds like you're saying the same thing we are, with the different words.
I require my view requires that God actually gather all evidence that might ever be necessary by anyone, rather than peeking into the future and saying, oh, here's what we need.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't think the nature of reality is such that the future exists before we make our choices that create it, which is different than it is heterodox. There's the word I was looking for. It is somewhat heterodox. You know, I share this view with Alvin Thompson, who says, yeah, there's about 20% of us that lack the gene, that have this genetic defect that makes this a problem for us. So this is the 20%. This is the 20%. What's the word I'm looking for? There was a movie by the name Alternate Opinion, Dissenting Opinion. This is the 20% of dissenting opinion. So anyway, I've made more of an issue out of it than I intended to. So let's go on.
Well, and listening to the discussion reminds me of something I heard Graham say. And this is God's transforming work in my heart, as I understand it. Heaven is not filled with a bunch of criminals with a red rubber stamp on their forehead. It's filled with people who no longer desire to be criminals and have transformed themselves.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
So, anyway.
I think the only thing left, Gene, is the rest who were killed with the sword, which differentiates, like, maybe just the common people versus the leadership who participated in that whole exploitive system. So, apparently, they died differently. I mean, it's like everybody dies, but they died for different reasons than the death of the system thrown into the lake of fire.
Well, the beast and the false prophet are systems. They're not people.
Mm-hmm.
So the rest are the people. The rest that made that system work.
Yeah.
Is that kind of what?
And they die from the word of God. from the revelation of truth.
Exactly. They die from the revelation of the character of God.
Yeah.
Well, shall we call it quits for today?
Yeah, I think we're about ready to hit 20.
It's time for that rest.
Okay, let's have our closing prayer. Father in heaven, we thank you for being with us this evening as we have discussed Revelation 19. We pray that as we continue, that everything will become clear to us, that we will see the final events pictured in Revelation in their true import. We pray for your spirit to guide us as we engage in that in the future. In Jesus' name, amen.